It was my absolute honor taking part in the screening of our documentary titled Holy Redemption. It was my privilege to moderate the panel titled Solidarity Activists versus Israel's Propaganda Machine Debunking Israeli Lies About the Palestinian Struggle. My guests were Medea Benjamin, Gideon Levy, Aaron Matei, and Ahmed Uta. They all discussed Israel's disinformation campaign and the impact that it's had on how people perceive Israel's war on Gaza today. Israel has put forward a countless amount of lies to justify its war on Gaza over the last 10 months. Unimaginable allegations that have not only dehumanized Palestinians, but has disinformed people across the globe, inciting violence through Islamophobia, through anti-Semitism. Today, we will discuss the impact Israel's disinformation campaign has had through mainstream media on a political level, and for the average Palestinian trying to make sense of this all. Thank you again to all of you joining us here at this very prominent event. Aaron, I want to start off with you because you've debunked some Israeli lies that have had a huge impact globally on how people perceive Palestinians overall and how they view Israel's war on Gaza today. Some of those lies, for the most part, is being used to justify the killings that are taking place in Gaza at the moment. Walk us through your findings since October 7th.
You know, the first thing to say about all of Israel's propaganda is that even if it were true, it still wouldn't justify Israel firing a single bullet into Gaza. Because Israel is an occupying power, and Israel, as an occupying power, doesn't have rights to self-defense. It has obligations. And when you're an occupying power, your obligation is to end the occupation. So even if all the false claims it made about what happened on October 7th were true, it still wouldn't justify anything that's happened since. All the carnage, all the horror. But Israel did put out fabricated tales because, for whatever reason, it wasn't satisfied with sticking to the truth. There were atrocities on October 7th. Palestinian militants did commit atrocities. They're on camera. But Israel went far beyond that. And immediately we got tales that were just false, dozens of beheaded babies. And when that fell apart, then came the allegation that Hamas committed systemic sexual violence on October 7th. And this claim is a lot harder to challenge because people don't want to be accused of denying such a horrific crime. So in the US media, immediately everybody pretty much accepted it as fact. But only a small number of us decided to do our jobs as journalists. And the job of a journalist is to stick to the facts. What is the available evidence? When it comes to this allegation, there was none. There was no physical evidence. There was no forensic evidence. There was no video. There were no identified victims, dead or alive, of sexual violence. Not even one case on October 7th, let alone on a mass scale, as Israel and its supporters alleged. All there was were claims from people who claimed to have been witnesses, none of which stood up to scrutiny. And one by one, all of them have fallen apart. All these anonymous witnesses that have been used by the New York Times, by CNN, by the BBC, all of their stories have fallen apart because they don't match up. There's no evidence to support them. For example, one witness claimed that, one alleged witness claimed she witnessed three severed heads on October 7th, along with seeing some horrific sexual violence that I won't get into because it's not worth repeating. And then the question becomes, when you claim to have seen three severed heads, is where are these heads? Where's the evidence for this? There was no trace of it. And Israeli police, if you read the Israeli media, admitted that there was no evidence for this. So those claims have fallen apart, but in the U.S. where I live, the establishment media is so in lockstep with the Israeli propaganda that there's been no self-correction, none. So there's been big stories that got a lot of attention in the New York Times. There was a documentary put out by Sheryl Sandberg, one of the former executives of Meta, Facebook, about Hamas's so-called sexual violence. It was screened at the White House by Kamala Harris. And even though all the claims in it have been shown to be false, there's been no retraction whatsoever. But anybody with their eyes open knows that this is propaganda. And the aim is very clear. The aim was to present Hamas and Palestinians as so barbaric, so demonic, that they could not be negotiated with, there could not be a ceasefire, that it was okay to go in and wipe out all of Gaza along with them because these people commit such horrific crimes. And the irony on top of these claims being false is that on top of it being a cover for Israeli mass murder, it was also a cover for Israel's actual crimes, because who really commits sexual violence? Well, we know who it is. It's the Israeli military. It's on tape. There's recently a video from inside a prison where, on camera, a Palestinian prisoner was sexually assaulted in the most brutal, sadistic way. And inside Israel, there's been a controversy because there are people protesting for the right of Israeli soldiers to commit this type of horrific sexual violence. So that's who was really guilty of sexual violence, and that's why Palestinians were falsely accused of being guilty of it. And unfortunately, in journalism, there were very few people willing to call it out from the start.
So, Gideon, back to my point on the 40 beheaded babies. I mean, that was a misinformation and disinformation campaign that was led by the Israeli government. It was repeated by very prominent political figures, including Israel's closest ally, U.S. President Joe Biden. That disinformation campaign on its own, that lie on its own, how big of an impact has it had on how people view the atrocities that are unfolding in Gaza today and Israel's conduction of the war on Gaza today?
I want to suggest a different approach. There's no doubt that on the 7th of October, there were atrocities, there were crimes in Israel. But whatever it was, and whatever it wasn't, nothing justifies what followed it by Israel. And therefore, for me, the discussion now about one thing, another thing, whether sexual crimes or not, beheaded babies, they were not for sure, and what kind of crimes were they, by the end of the day, whatever was there was terrible, and whatever was there does not justify what happened in the last 10 months following this day. What happened to the Israeli society on this day is that almost all Israelis, and when I say all Israelis, it's really almost all Israelis, left and right, peaceniks or so-called peaceniks, and right-wingers and racists, everyone, believes that after the 7th of October, Israel has the right to do whatever it wants without any limits, neither moral or legal limits. The sky's the limit, or hell is the limit, and we can do whatever we want. The second conclusion is, including by the left camp or peace camp or what remains of it, is that Israel doesn't care anymore. Israel public opinion doesn't care anymore about the Palestinians. They don't want to know, they don't want to hear, and they don't care. Some of them are even happy about what is happening to the Palestinians in Gaza. Some of them are very proud about it because they think they deserve it. And this is so horrible because we face a society which really went mad. The media is obviously, as usually, the biggest collaborator with this, not showing anything from Gaza, not because the government tells the media not to show Gaza, only because they don't want to bother the viewers and the readers. They want them to be happy with themselves and content with themselves and not bother them with all kinds of questions. And therefore, Israeli public opinion and Israeli media is today in its lowest point ever. And here I want to say again and to stress it. On the 7th of October, there were crimes that shouldn't have happened. Were they worse or less worse is irrelevant. Whatever happened then has nothing to do with the behavior of Israel ever since then. 40,000 Palestinians killed, the destruction, the thousands of children, 10,000 are children among the victims. Those figures, this policy, cannot find any justification. If there were rapes on the 7th, if there were not, if even babies were beheaded or not, nothing can justify what happened ever since then.
Indeed. I mean, some of the people that were killed in Palestine, it happened on the Eshifa Medical Complex. And when we say the Eshifa Medical Complex, another Israeli propaganda line pops up into our mind, and that was of there being a Hamas base inside the complex, hence justifying the attacks that they conducted on the hospital. This is where I want to bring Ahmed in, because I don't know if you guys, many of you have probably seen the posts that Ahmed has been sharing on his social media platforms. He's a nurse. He worked for the most part in Eshifa Hospital during his time in Gaza. He recently came back. He's seen atrocities beyond anything that any of us can imagine. He's tried to tend to patients there. I mean, Ahmed, just first off, walk me through your experience, your personal experience in Eshifa, the things you witnessed there, the interactions that you had with your colleagues, with your patients, and the overall situation while enduring the constant bombardment.
So, again, thank you for having me here also. It's always different when there's a person on ground that can speak in a perspective that may reach the people in an understanding of a westernized way. So before speaking about Shifa Hospital, any human being should have the right for treatment, should have the right for medication, should have the right to go to the hospital safely and return home with a treatment plan. Now, when we first went to Shifa Hospital, Shifa Hospital in Gaza is the heart of the health sector system. People, cases from all the way from Rafah, the very south, and Beit Hanun, the very north, when cases are complicated in any of the hospitals, they're referred to a Shifa Hospital. That's how powerful and strong the Shifa Hospital is in Gaza, and it means a lot to the people in Gaza, the medical staff, and the health system in general. Now, once 7th of October all happened, I was supposed to be at university that day discussing with my professor a couple things with the defending my master's thesis. Unfortunately, until today, I have no idea where he is, how he's doing, what's going to be happening with our future. A couple days in, I found myself at the hospital from the severity of the situation that was happening, because we knew that after what had happened, the situation wasn't going to be very smooth. We endured a couple or a lot of escalations and wars all over the years in Gaza. So the situation wasn't the best before the beginning of October, and that's what people tend to not understand, thinking that Gaza was a place full of safetiness and everybody is able to do whatever they want. Unfortunately, that wasn't the case. Even for the health system, a lot of people, they needed to be transferred out of the Gaza Strip in order to get advanced medication. So once we entered the Shifa Hospital, I remember the first thing that I faced was our medical colleague. He was a doctor, and he didn't receive any patient. He received his father and his brother. They were martyrs, and from the severity of the attack, they came in. He didn't know if he was able to identify them. Imagine yourself at the age 40 and how long you've been able to see your brother and your father on a daily basis. They come in to the hospital. You can't identify them from the brutality of the airstrikes that fall on the residential places in Gaza. So when I saw this moment, and I was just there with seeing all the injuries that were coming in, the first thing that came to my mind was, with every ambulance, every siren you can hear, was, will this be my family, or will this be somebody I personally know or have a memory with? Of course, everybody in Gaza is beloved to us, but again, somebody being a close relative, somebody being you having memories with, a colleague, a friend, any so ever, it hurts you a little bit more, because you have to deal with this case and you have to grieve it. And unfortunately, I can say most of the people in working in the health industries have faced something like this, because every household in Gaza has lost a beloved person. If it was a mother, a father, a husband, a wife, or the whole family. A lot of times you would have children that come in, and one of their family member would be alive, if it was a father or a external extended relative. The case would be very critical. It would be very difficult to deal with it. The family of this patient would hit us with statements that are already we're in a very difficult state because of the medical situation that's going on and the critical injury that this child or this case is with. And then all you hear is that this is the only person left from the family, or this is the only person that I have left, or this person, like, if you're not able to rescue them, if you're not able to get them back to life, then the whole family is going to be wiped off the registered civilians of the people in Gaza for this whole family. And you can imagine Arab families and Arab culture, how extended their families are and how much they do reproduce and have children. So when you hear these statements, it shocks you to a point that you have to come up with a way to grieve with this family. You have to come up with a way to try and work as hard as you can with this patient, knowing that sometimes it's a hopeless case. A lot of times there would be cases and children, they're giving out their last breaths. We call it in like gasping breathing, of course. When like somebody says this from the medical team, we know that this case most likely is going to die. The family don't know that, but all they can see is that their child or their family member is breathing, and that they are full of anger and rage. Some families understand it because unfortunately, they've been already put in situations like this before, right, having lost a lot of family members. Some families, they don't accept it, and they won't even believe that you can't help them. You're trying everything you can. The whole team is in there doing as much as you can. But the most you can do is probably tell them that spend the last couple minutes with them. They're very unconscious, but you can see them breathe because they're going to die.
Well, it's scenarios like this that have caused this rage, that have brought people together to talk about the struggle that Palestinians have been facing, the genocide that Palestinians have been facing since October 7, but even before, prior to October 7. I mean, we've seen protests worldwide here in Istanbul. We've seen it in the UK, in the US, Medea, some of those you were at the forefront of. And, you know, it's been 10 months. It's been 10 months, and people have been protesting week after week. And some have this fatigue. They're asking, does protesting matter? Is it making a difference? What would you say to that?
Absolutely. And let me first say how thankful I am to TRT for doing this extraordinary documentary, because when we walk in the halls of Congress, we are oftentimes confronted by congresspeople who said, there was peace before October 7th. Everything was fine. And this is all the fault of Hamas, and every single death is the fault of Hamas. And we say, things were not peaceful before October 7th. Now we have a fantastic documentary that I hope we will be able to show inside our Congress, in the theater in Congress, to say that things were not fine before October 7th. So thank you so much for this. And I just want to give a little background, because I think your audience is not from the United States, to say a couple of things. One, Israel would not be able to do what it is doing and has done without the support of the US, that gives the majority of the weapons, the diplomatic cover, and that both of our political parties that have a chance at winning the election have a terrible position on Israel. Trump has been so pro-Israel that he moved the embassy to Jerusalem, that he started these Abraham Accords to try to get around the Palestinian problem by making, quote, peace between the Arab countries and Israel. Biden came in and continued that, and we now see with Kamala Harris, people are thinking something's going to happen, something's going to change, she's more sympathetic. But yet, My partner Tig and I just came from the Democratic National Convention in Chicago yesterday, where there were a group of Palestinians who were actually doing a sit-in that turned into a sleep-in in front of the Congress, because they were demanding something so simple and easy to give into, and that was they were asking for literally 2 minutes of time during the convention to have the voice of a Palestinian American. 2 minutes. At that convention, you had the voices of Israel, of hostages, you had the voices of Republicans, you had the voices of CEOs. They kept saying, this is a big tent, a big tent. That tent wasn't big enough for a 2 minute talk by a Palestinian American. That gives you an indication. I think we should probably say boo instead of clapping, because it's just so horrific. And it gives you the sense about how the people in power in both parties and in Congress are still so locked in to this narrative that Israel is a democracy, Israel is our ally, and they've created their own bubble. So what is happening outside the bubble is the protest movement. And the protest movement is shown by public opinion polls that we represent the majority. And we have for a long time. In fact, since last August, there was a poll done that said 86% of the American people wanted a ceasefire. That was before everybody started watering down what a ceasefire means. And now we see that the majority of people don't want to keep supporting weapons to slaughter babies in Gaza. And yet the people in power will not listen to us. They keep telling us that we have to recognize that Israel needs to defend itself. Over and over we hear that mantra. But the people aren't buying it. And we had lots of demonstrations on the streets during the Democratic Convention. We're really looking forward to the students coming back in September and reinvigorating the encampments and the student movement that existed before. There are lots of people who have been leaving the administration in disgust, who have very important voices. And we have a real generation gap, especially among Jews. Aaron and I are Jewish. He is younger than me, but I think we're still of an older generation compared to the 20-year-olds who are involved in groups like If Not Now and Jewish Voice for Peace. They work with the Muslim groups. We work really well together. And there are constant, constant protests. And I think this is going to keep happening, keep building, and put pressure on the different administrations, put pressure on our elected officials, and put pressure on everybody in power who continues to toe this line, that this lie that Israel is a democratic country and Israel is an ally we have to support. So I'm optimistic that there's going to be a lot more effective protests in the coming weeks. And one thing I would like to put out, since we're in an international audience here, is that we really need to come up with a global day of action where we around the world can come out and say, no more weapons to Israel, no more trade with Israel, no more support for this oppressive apartheid government, free Palestine.
I mean, on your point for the DNC, a lot of the uncommitted voters in the United States and those that do support the Democrats have also come out and said that, you know, they're disappointed. They're disappointed with the outcome because they didn't get the 2 minutes of speech that they, you know, rightfully should have had on that platform if the Democrats do genuinely support the two-state solution and support the Palestinians and the Israelis to live in peace. A lot of what's being said by political figures, understandably, they make headlines. And Aaron, this is where I'm going to bring you in. How much of a moral obligation do media outlets have in terms of fact-checking the information that they go on to share with the public? How big of an impact does mainstream media still have on how people perceive the events in Gaza today?
Well, media outlets have an obligation, if they take themselves seriously as journalists, to simply be factual. But if you look at how the U.S. media has covered Gaza, I mean, covered Palestine for decades, but especially since October 7th, they've taken on the job of being stenographers for Israel. Basically, whatever Israel says, so many establishment outlets in the U.S. just repeat it as fact. For example, CNN said on air that CNN had confirmed that there were dozens of beheaded babies. And what was their source? The Israeli government told them so. That's CNN. So many major newspapers who have teams of reporters on the ground printed these lies from Israel that Al-Shifa Hospital, where you've worked, was being used as a Hamas command and control center. And what was the basis for that? Israeli officials told them so. So if they cared about ethics, journalism, they'd be subjecting Israeli claims to scrutiny, but they haven't done that. The propaganda is just, it's unbelievable. The positive thing, and this is in parallel with all the activism that we've seen in the U.S. and around the world, and that Medea has been such an important part of, is, you know, as people are taking to the streets, they're also turning off cable news. They're shutting out established media because they've lost all credibility. You can only be lied to so many times before people stop paying attention to you and taking you seriously. And that, fortunately, is what happened in the U.S. People are looking to alternative sources now. People are watching outlets like TRT now and Al Jazeera and The Gray Zone, where I work, and alternative media sites that are filling the vacuum, that are filling the void that's been left by establishment media that that would rather repeat Israeli propaganda than do its job.
Gideon, let me bring you in at this point, because I think we're going to touch on a very important topic regarding Israel's war on Gaza. If Hamas returns the remaining hostages today, will Israel end its war on Gaza?
Unfortunately, the answer is no, but I would like only to refer to Aaron's things, because what Aaron said shows how everything is relative. You know, Aaron, I cannot watch anymore any Israeli media outlet except of Haaretz, but for sure no TV. And my rescue, my place where I find some kind of relief is CNN. And CNN for me, I mean, I wish the Israeli media would have been at least like CNN. Now you can understand how bad it is here, because CNN still shows some images from Gaza, which you hardly can see here. CNN gives some voice to the people of Gaza, to the suffer of Gaza, which you can't see here. So everything is really relative. Now, getting back to your question, it's very clear, and it's not to me to say, it's for the Prime Minister of Israel to say, that Israel does not want, the official Israel of Netanyahu does not want to end this war, period, without any conditions. That's the main obstacle to get a ceasefire now, because basically Israel does not want to end the war at this stage. 40,000 victims are not enough for Israel to stop the war. Becoming a pariah state is not enough for Israel to stop the war. Hundreds of Israeli soldiers who are killed on a daily basis are not enough for Israel to stop the war. And you don't see protests against it. You see a lot of protests in Israeli society against Netanyahu, in favor of releasing the hostages, but you don't hear a very clear voice to stop the war at once. And I say one more thing, which is more depressing than this. When I look at, because, you know, Netanyahu became the demon of many, many Israelis and also many people in the West. When I look at the list of the candidates who might replace them, or might replace him, from all kinds of parties, center parties, even leftist parties, none of them, and really none of them, is ready to release all the Palestinian prisoners and to stop the war for getting the hostages. None of them, but really none of them, is ready to put an end not only to the war, but to the siege over Gaza, to the occupation, and to the apartheid. And the differences between all the Israeli Zionist politicians, which are almost all the Israeli politicians, Jewish politicians, are so minor, because in in the world, there's always this hope, oh, if we just get rid of Netanyahu, Israel will turn back to its what it was, this paradise of human rights and peaceful people and prosperity. No, the problem is that what Netanyahu stands for is reflecting very, very deep and wide opinions among Israeli society, and much more so after the 7th.
Medea, I want to bring you in here on Gideon's note, because that what he just said bears the question of, so when are we going to witness the breaking point? When are we going to come to the point where they say enough is enough and we need to resolve this situation? And this, of course, have to come from prominent political figures, namely the United States, given that they are Israel's biggest ally. What would you say on that?
Well, we in the United States have our work cut out for us to do to try to show politicians that taking money from the pro-Israel groups like AIPAC is dirty money, is compromising money, and that if they want to be clean politicians, they have to renounce this money. Now, that's going to be difficult because almost all of our politicians take that money. Some take $1 million, some take $30,000. We've seen the influence of AIPAC in the elections happening right now, where they vowed to put $100 million into these elections, and they've already put $30 million into primaries to eliminate two of the most outspoken members of Congress who were for a ceasefire. That means we have to come back way stronger than that, protect every member in Congress who is speaking out in favor of a ceasefire, and more than a ceasefire, who is now calling for a moratorium on weapons to Israel. That is our real demand right now. And I think we have a time during this electoral season to be at every rally that Kamala Harris is going to hold and that Donald Trump is going to hold, to be at every town hall that these Congress people are going to do during their election season. And we are there, and we're there, and we're speaking out, and we're pushing, pushing, pushing. So I think it's very clear what our role is, because if we manage to start marginalizing these lobby groups, and it's not just AIPAC, it's also Christian Zionists, like Christians United for Israel. It is also the weapons manufacturers, because they love this war, like they love all wars. That's where they get their profit. But I think now there's enough of us, and we talked about the young people. When I went out to the encampments, I was so pleasantly surprised that the people in the encampments were not just saying this is about Gaza. They were saying this is about the military-industrial complex. This is about the weapons industry. This is about the war economy. They understood that this is much larger. In fact, many of them were saying this is about capitalism. But it was good to see that we've got now a lot of new, young, smart, sophisticated people who will be using every day in the next weeks and months coming up to the elections to start putting out the message that supporting Israel is supporting genocide, apartheid, ethnic cleansing, and if you have a moral bone in your body, you would not keep supporting Israel.
Fine. I want to bring our attention to a saying that many Palestinians have been using for decades, and that being, from the river to the sea, Palestine will be free. Now, since October 7, there's been a lot of controversy around this saying, namely from Israelis who say that this saying means that they want to eradicate Israelis from that land. So that's something that I want to address. Ahmed, for us, can you tell us what from the river to the sea, Palestine will be free, means to you as a Palestinian?
So this brings us to the very beginning of the occupation of the occupation state, which is so-called Israel. Because before that, actually, unfortunately, Palestine was given to the Israelis by the Britons. And what Palestine, from the river to the sea, Palestine will be free, it means every meter from Palestine is the right for Palestinians. It's basic common sense. This is land for Palestinians. If you come and ask or do a statistic with the background or the native land of where the Israeli IDs for people are, none of them would be from Palestine. And there are actual statistics and proof that shows that, because the big ships that came in 1947 that said, the Germans destroyed our dreams, don't you dare destroy our hopes. And of course, as Palestinians that carry humanity and teach the world lessons in humanity, we've been seeing that in the last 10 months, because that's the most people were paying attention to the Palestinian cause. They welcomed them in 1947. They let them in. They even made them Palestinian IDs to be part of people from Palestine. 1 year later, the Nakba happened. And what the Nakba really is, they came in with groups of settlers and teams and whatever you want to call it, army whatsoever. They are the ones that are called terrorists. I don't know who puts the definition to the word terrorism and places it to a certain people, but we clearly have all of that wrong. Like, we shouldn't be following a certain person that says 1, 2, and 3 is right before we actually see it with our eyes or study it, because I'm pretty sure I've seen a lot of people that are, they were pro-Israeli or thinking what Western media says from the power that Western media holds and how Israel bought all the propaganda to be anti-Semitic and against the Palestinians. Their point of view is completely different the moment they visit Palestine. The most they can visit is the West Bank. And our friend Robert is one of the people. The moment you visit the West Bank, you see how people are being treated. You see how people with the right of the land, indigenous Palestinians, are being humiliated, kicked out of their homes, ethnically cleansed, shot, killed, and nobody can even talk about it because of how Western media controls the titles of what's going on. So from the river to the sea, really, it's every meter in Palestine is the right for Palestinians. If we were generous by welcoming you, not having a place, that does not give you the right to churn against the people that gave you their places, that shared with you their bread, their food, in order to find a place for yourself to live in, and now call it your state. And clearly, it only happened in 1948, and since 1948 until today, Palestine has been living massacre upon massacre that are all hidden, that nobody talks about. Even today, we are in a state, every person in this room is probably numb from the news that we hear and the massacres that we all see. I'm pretty sure you've all seen pure massacres that come out from individuals in Gaza more than the news stations. At first, you probably were really heated about it and upset. And the only way for you to talk about the next massacre is if the massacre after that was more brutal. And that's what we're seeing right now. Nobody is talking about a massacre, even though we're speaking right now over here. We've been speaking for 10 months, and every single day, the massacres are just worse. The level of displacement, the level of the brutality, even the weapons being used are being trialed in Gaza on the people of Gaza. Like, just take a moment. People of Gaza are fragile, like every person in this room. You step on a nail, you're not able to walk for like a week. Imagine these people are having hot shrapnels in their body from certain attacks, stuck under homes from airstrikes. Even like from Gaza perspective to the West Bank, it's very different. Like any person in Gaza will not just not accept, but they will do the most they can to not let any Israeli settlers in Gaza, because honestly, they just can't live apart. They can't live together. Seeing the person that has murdered your family, destroyed your life, destroyed everything that you've built, killed your beloved ones, control you and be in your streets, something people in Gaza can't have. Whereas in the West Bank, unfortunately, that's where they grew up between the checkpoints, they grew up with Israeli settlers or Israeli soldiers arming down their houses and destroying, doing so much destruction, abducting people for no crime, just for the sake of it. Just for the sake of, oh, he might say something.
Right. All of what we're going to witness and see firsthand by the amazing work that our investigative team at TRT World has done by preparing and producing Holy Redemption, Stealing Palestinian Land. It's a very interesting documentary that touches on everything that you kind of mentioned, Ahmed. Medea, you said that you're Jewish, Aaron's Jewish, Gideon is Jewish. I mean, when you conduct your work, you're automatically labeled from a certain group of people as being anti-Semitic. And I want to get your view, and Aaron's view, and Gideon's view. I want the three of you to kind of chime in on here to tell me about anti-Semitism versus anti-Zionism, and how it's become such a significant talking point during debates for pro-Israeli people to use against you and your faith. So, Aaron, let me start off with you on that one.
I hope by now people can just not even pay attention to anybody accusing critics of Israel of being anti-Semitic. It's just such a joke. Nobody takes it seriously anymore. It has been used to silence people. It is effective, but hopefully by now seeing what that's been used for, it's been used to justify a massacre of tens of thousands of people, to destroy their homeland, to deliberately cut off food, fuel, water, medicine from Gaza. Hopefully by now it's worn its welcome. I mean, personally for me, it resonates. My family survived the Nazi regime. My father, Gabor, was born and nearly died in infancy under Nazi Germany in Hungary. So I take it very personally when my family's suffering is weaponized to justify a new genocide, a new Holocaust against the Palestinian people in my name. And on the question of From the River to the Sea, I wanted to make one point. There are two uses of From the River to the Sea. There's the Palestinian one, but there's also the Israeli one. And it's been around since the late 1970s. It's in the Likud Party Charter, which is the party that Benjamin Netanyahu comes from. And it says in the Likud Party Charter, From the River to the Sea, there will be only Jewish sovereignty, which means that we control all this land. We have the right to it. We have the right to steal the indigenous people's land. And that is the policy of the Israeli government that is in practice. It's not just a slogan, it's actually in practice, which the U.S. government is fully behind. So while claiming to be offended by Palestinians saying we want freedom, they're actively supporting the Israeli government and saying from the river to the sea, we only control this land, we're the supremacists here, they don't have rights. And that's the supremacy, that's the slogan in real life that we have to stop.
Right, Medea, let me get your thoughts, and then I'm going to cross to Gideon for his final thoughts as well, because we have well run out of time. Medea.
Maybe I disagree a little bit with you, Aaron, on that nobody believes it anymore, because I see that in the Congress, where we have two branches, we have the House and the Senate. In the House, they've already passed a bill to redefine what anti-Semitism means and include in their examples of anti-Zionism being part of anti-Semitism. They want to get that passed in the Senate. And then they are passing legislation all over different states, and they want to do it nationally, against the boycott, divestment, and sanction movement, saying that that is anti-Semitic. And that is one of the few nonviolent tools that we have to be boycotting and opposing companies and other entities that are working with Israel. I don't know what it's like here, but I know when I go to places in the Middle East, I see that people aren't going to Starbucks anymore, and they aren't going to McDonald's, and their profits have plunged. These kinds of targeting of individual companies, in the case of students, for example, trying to find out where their investments are and disinvest from companies that are involved in Israel. This is a very important tool that we have, and so we can't allow them to call those tools anti-Semitic. We know they're not, but the Congress is trying to make that into a law that would limit our abilities to use boycott, divestment, and sanctions.
I should have said no decent person takes it seriously. People in Congress don't count, obviously.
Okay, Gideon, let me get your thoughts on the anti-Semitism versus anti-Zionism. And I also want to ask you on this final note, because my director is pushing me to end the panel. We're running out of time. But will a two-state solution work at this point?
So I start with the second one, and this refers also to the slogan, from the river to the sea, Palestine will be free. That's my vision, and it's different than Ahmed's vision, and it's different than other visions, and it's the only visible vision, not reality, but vision. For me, between the river and the sea, there should be a democracy. Nothing but a democracy, with equal rights, one person, one vote, without any difference between any ethnic, religious, or national identity. That's the only way to find a solution. That's the only way to bring some kind of justice. Total justice will not prevail, because what was suggested just a few minutes ago was to bring justice to the Palestinians and then injustice to the Jews who live in Palestine, because where will we go then? I think we should share one state. The two-state solution is a better solution. It's a more visible solution. But we have to realize that Israel killed this solution, and it's not relevant anymore and not achievable. And we better understand it and get adjust to it. Continuing to talk about the two-state solution is playing to the hands of the occupation, because everyone who knows the reality knows very well that there are 700,000 Jewish settlers in the West Bank, and there will never be an Israeli government who will be able to evacuate this very powerful group in Israeli society. No way. Without the total evacuation, there is no viable state. There is Bantustans. And therefore, the two-state solution is the train that left the station, unfortunately so. And we are left only with the one-state solution. We are living in a one-state for over 50 years now. The only problem is its regime. The only problem is it's not a democracy. And the only options left are either an apartheid state or a democracy. There is no third option. Yes, it means losing the chance for Palestinian self-determination and Jewish self-determination. No Palestinian state, no Jewish state, but at least democracy. And this will make this place much more just. As about the anti-Semitism, I can just tell you, I admire the efficiency of Israeli propaganda, Israel and the Jewish lobby all over the world. They succeeded to silence, to shut up almost all the world. They claim that any criticism about Israel or about the occupation or about the apartheid is anti-Semitism. And you see the results. Look at Western media, mainly in Europe. You can hardly say a bad word about Israel or about the occupation, because immediately you are accused as an anti-Semite. And the propaganda is using it and manipulating it, because nobody in Europe wants to be claimed as an anti-Semite. And my appeal is, it's about time for civil societies not to fall anymore to this trap. It is a question of freedom of speech, freedom of expression. There are anti-Semites in the world, and they should be fought. But most of the critics of Israel today are people of conscience. You cannot be today a man or a woman of conscience and support the occupation of the war in Gaza. Impossible. And this has nothing to do with anti-Semitism. Anti-Semitism is to support the war in Gaza and then blame the Jews for this mess.
All right, Gideon Levy, thank you so much for your contributions. And to all of our panelists, Ahmed Kuta, Aaron Matei, Medea, Benjamin, thank you all for joining us here today at this very important screening of Holy Redemption, which is going to take place in a couple of hours from now at around 7:30, 8 p.m. Here in this room. Thank you all very much for your contributions.
Can I say something?
Of course, yeah.
Thank you, everyone. Of course, the time for us to speak is very limited. We can be speaking about what's happening in Gaza for hours without being tired because we are full of rage and anger. When we say where the world is, I'm pretty sure everybody in this room is here because they care about the cause and they care to support. We have been talking for 10 months, unfortunately. Coming to events like these, we aren't just here to have a normal talk. It's more to actually change the people, and I would more say challenge. I really challenge everybody in this room, worldwide, anywhere, that is standing with the cause to do something for the people in Palestine, specifically for the people in Gaza right now. Whenever the Israeli cries for support, they get billions of dollars support in weapons. People in Gaza barely get aid airdrop that is thrown on the borders. When they go get them, they get shot. In the beach, people have drowned, and it hits people's homes that is already like a tent or barely holding itself, killing people and destroying their homes. So I do want to end by saying the whole world has seen what's happening. The world is probably throwing a blind spot. Again, I do not intend to mean you guys, because you guys are all here for the support and the cause of Palestine. But please try and challenge, and I personally say it, and everybody in Gaza is saying it, they do challenge the world to have a change, to have a ceasefire. And then from there, other stuff can happen. Thank you, everyone.
And let's go for a global day of action in October. We know the Israelis going to take October 7th and make it a big, big day. We have to either go right before or right after to have a global day to say end the genocide.
Yes.
There you have it. Thank you all so much for your time and your contributions. I really, really appreciate it.